This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. And I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm interviewing DeWitt Henry, one of the founders and longstanding editors of Plowshares Magazine, based in Boston. How are you, DeWitt?
Fine, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, me as well. Now, Plowshares has a distinction, I think. It's been going for now 43 years. You founded it in 1971 in Boston. And maybe you could tell the founding story, because I think it's a pretty interesting one, that Plowshares came out of a bar in Boston. Or was it Cambridge?
No, it was Cambridge.
Right.
The Plow and the Stars Bar, which was an Irish pub at a time when most people in Harvard Square didn't know what that meant. But it was started in the spirit that goes back apparently to the Irish Revival and in Ireland, and the fact that pubs in Ireland are in fact cultural centers. And many of them have broadsheets, and their drinking poets share that way.
And how did you come up with the name Plowshares? Why wasn't the magazine named, you know, it could have been named The Plow and the Stars. So how did you kind of morph that into Plowshares?
Well, the founding group had come to Boston, Cambridge as one of the sanctuaries, I think, for both writing and, well, obviously graduate schools of different kinds, and alternative press journalism. One of the long-standing, along with things like the Berkeley Barb in this area, this is the Boston Phoenix. And the Phoenix had just been started by a man named Harper Barnes. And some of the early Plowshares people, like George Kimball, who had been to the University of Iowa in the Writers' Workshop, tended to, the office was down the street, and they tended to hang out in this pub, The Plow and the Stars. As did people like Aram Saroyan and Bill Corbett and some 60s small press people that kind of look backward. Ben Randall Press, James Randall, who was a professor at the Emerson College, I think had a great admiration for Black Sparrow and shared some of the same authors. So there's a sort of melange of maverick people that came from, as I thought about it earlier, other sanctuaries, which tended to be small sort of literary situations, sometimes in the classroom, sometimes not. So the Haight-Ashbury world, the Black Mountain Poets world, the world of, in my case, the Iowa Writers' Workshop in Harvard and Amherst College, all sort of found themselves in this Irish pub, and there was a sort of hail fellow recognition of somebody else who was in their 20s and who had an experience of being supported in their dream to write, and now found themselves in the world, and felt distinctly excluded from the world. The publishing establishment in those days is what we called it, with a capital E. And it amounted to the Atlantic Monthly and Houghton Mifflin in Boston, and people that we saw being paid to either write or to edit. And they were, because they were making a living and felt validated, not welcoming. There's a wonderful essay called Sad Hearts in the Supermarket, about the, do you remember who wrote that? Does it ring any bells?
It does.
I'm thinking Randall Jarrell.
Yeah, I can't remember. I don't remember who wrote it.
But the idea of it was sort of the writers of the day felt that they were on the outside of the picture window, and the inside was this kind of suburban world of affluence and comfort. And we felt sad, literally sad hearts in the supermarket. The supermarket was a display of all the goods of America, you know, and the sad heart were the have-nots that couldn't afford to get them. And that tended to be the poets. So there was that sense that we were excluded from a publishing establishment, sending poetry or fiction or whatever had braved the criticism of your peers in these sanctuaries, led to rejection. But there were more of us than there were of them. One wasn't a sad heart as in the sense of solitary. There were you turned to the right or left, and over their pint of Guinness, you saw another sad heart, another one, several of those sad hearts had in their various paths something to do with magazines. So the American side of this in the pub. I forget exactly who it might have been. It might have been Bill Corbett, it might have been Ernst & Royer, it might have been any number of people. But they said, let's do a magazine. And the bartender was a Dubliner named Peter O'Malley, who was also our age, and he was an adventurer who had brought some family money and invested in this pub and turned it into an Irish pub. It had been just a mailman spit on the floor bar before that, and they styled it up to make it something like the Lancet in New York. Well, he said, well, you know, like in Ireland, we do broadsheets, so why don't we do a broadsheet? And so everybody came up with poems, or knew people who had poems or stories, and threw them in a big box for the broadsheet, and nothing happened. And I went back a year later and said, whatever happened? And Peter took me down into the basement and showed me this box. And said, well, we had the idea of doing a broadsheet, but it just didn't go anywhere. And I said, well, why not do a literary magazine? Something like the Transatlantic Review. And he said, yeah, that sounds good. Do you know anything about that? And I said, well, yeah, I edited the undergraduate magazine in Amherst College for 3 years, and I'm teaching writing at Harvard now as a teaching fellow, and I have a group that I meet with, you know, of friends, and, I'm aware of some good work. And he said, well, why don't we have an organizing meeting? And so in his apartment down the street, these personages, posturing in the mirrors of their own disappointment, gathered, and everybody was interested, but they were mutually intolerant. Like we all had our directions. You think of new directions as a modernist impulse in publishing the, you know, literary magazines. Well, there were a lot of agendas. There was a lot of ideas of what good was when it came to writing. And if one was moving in a certain direction, an aesthetic, then the fun was arguing. So it struck me, coming from my background, which might have had a lot to do with the new criticism tradition, I thought, well, you know, this is energy. This is what got Huck Finn's or Tom Sawyer's fence painted, you know. So let's argue. And I like the idea of there was an early television, you may remember, something called the Four Star Theater,
yeah,
which was a consortium basically of five prominent actors, and they joined forces, and each one of them got a show, on a kind of revolving basis. So I said, well, why not have a revolving editorship? Well, you know, we'll have the best of two worlds in a sense. Everybody will get a chance to do the tradition, the modernist tradition of the editorial visionary, who is pushing an agenda. But there'll be the added feature of disagreement. And, you know, so you do your issue, and it can be a Black Mountain issue, but if I don't understand or appreciate Black Mountain and you can't teach me to, I'm going to put something else in your face, you know? And I will make my best argument for my criteria. And what we have in common is that we're all sad hearts in the supermarket. We're all outsiders. And that our collective convictions should generate an audience. And of course, in our earliest dreams, we all believed that there should be an audience. And I think it was probably the real paper in the Boston Phoenix and the whole idea of alternative journalism that had first subverted the journalistic establishment, which was tied to the idea of circulation. So the great revolution of these weeklies, alternative weeklies, was that they got people to hawk them on the corners, you know. And you're looking at basically the generation gap during and after the Vietnam War, which was an extreme division between haves and have-nots, oldies and youngies, and there was a brave contest of the way things are. Some of it was political, some of it was personal, you know, but basically alternative journalism gave us the example of finding a different way to talk to each other, that our generation, our 20-something generation, was being overlooked and misunderstood by those who held power and who were the gatekeepers for culture. The idea of this collective of people with different criteria or different literary agendas did have mutual regard and respect as a function of being excluded. I thought that was, and it proved to be later, good, because in the history of the literary magazine, the more traditional Sid Corman kind of, that's a Black Mountain vision, or the Dadaist schools, or the language school poets. I mean, there were all these different new directions, and they tended to be really intolerant because theirs was the only right. And coming from my background, I just wanted to encourage the conversation and underscore the fact that the conversation and the question of what makes literature or how literature makes sense of life was what was important. And fortunately, for us anyway, the bar paid for advance on for future advertising for the bar, paid for the first issue, which cost $2,000. And Peter took it to Ireland, so it had 75p as a price on one side of the cover and $2 on the other side. He took them to Dublin and showed them around. And he had also been over there earlier and had some network that among Irish poets, which is a very small clan, and he had brought work back, and some of it got into the early issues. But legendarily, Desmond O'Grady, who was a sort of an Irish Ezra Pound, knew Ezra Pound and had one of Pound's cantos, and presumably Peter had this, and he was drinking at the Lion's Head in New York and left his briefcase on a bar stool. And we've never heard of that since. that's the fish that got away.
Oh, that's great. Well, so in the first, you know, in the first 3 years, you published one issue a year, and then after that,
we called it an occasional.
Right, and then after that, you went to a more regular schedule. But how were you? selling the magazine in those early years? Now, I know it was perfect bound. I think, was it 6x9 or 5.5x8.5?
5.5x8.5. It was literally laid out over a copy of the Transatlantic Review.
Got it. And so you use that as your model.
Right. And in those days, of course, technology was offset printing and cold composition.
Right. And using photographic reproduction and like type laid out in pages by hand.
Right. On a light table. Like a collage with glue.
Right. Cutting and pasting, we used to call it.
And and then I worked in the early nexus of people. Thomas Lux was around, and he had just graduated from Emerson College, and James Randall of the Pym Randall Press was his professor and did his early work, published his first book. And so Tom had a roommate and friend who had quit Emerson and got a job in a Boston print shop named Joe Wilmot. And together, he and Tom started something called the Barn Dream Press. A barn dream is what a cow has during the working day. To make it possible, I put in the labor in the print shop. And I did the pasting up, but I also opaqued the negatives and did everything up to the point of actually burying the plates and running the press, which Joe did. And so that first printing bill was reasonable in the day. It was, it was a little under $2,000. And Peter covered it. But I also had $800 in savings as a graduate student, and I invested that in it. That's all the money we had. And the rest of it was zeal and volunteerism.
And you would sell, but you sold copies.
So we of our group, the ones who knew New York went down to New York, went down to the Bowery, and there were three literary bookstores in New York at the time. They took them on consignment. And then we had other friends out in Berkeley, and they took some on consignment. Jack Shoemaker's bookstore in the old days.
Right,
nobody had heard of CCLM in our crowd. That came later. And nobody had heard or really thought seriously about the National Endowment for the Arts. But that was the grant opportunities as they arose that made the next issue possible and the next one after that, that kind of thing. And that brings up a whole other story of the encouragement of quixotic outsiders by public policy, and taking a young graduate student like me and giving him enough that he works on zeal. And as you know, in those days, we always said the printers get paid, but the poets don't.
Mm-hmm. No, it was always, the editors, the poets, everybody involved. It was all volunteer labor at that point.
And of course, we're writers, or we're teachers and students, but we're basically not tradespeople, and we know nothing about publishing. So the impetus, the writer's impetus of there should be an audience, is totally contrary to logic. I mean, there's no sense of marketing whatsoever. you don't ask, you don't do a market survey. You have no measure of demand. But neither did the trade publishers at that point. We really felt that they were blind to an existing audience, that needed art and needed serious literature, as we saw it, and was getting bestsellerdom. Another model that factored in here for me was public broadcasting. In fact, I wrote an article in 1980 looking back on the decade and called it public publishing in Boston. And I thought the salvation was libraries. I thought that to get back to your initial question, we had 2,000 copies of Plowshares, or 1,000, I don't remember. I think it was 2,000. Later we reprinted it. They sold in the bar, some. Others were taken, in the equivalent of backpacks to these various literary bookstores that people knew about or had friends who knew about. And, of course, they were seeded out to family and friends and that kind of stuff. But there was no, the big book fairs hadn't started yet, too. That was yet another thing. It was just our problem, our bar problem, our Plowshares problem. How are we going to sell this? And the answer was on a 40% discount on the consignment. Somebody had to go back and double park and get tickets and all this kind of stuff. Right. And we had 19 bookstores in Cambridge, in Harvard Square. That was something significant. So you could hand distribute perhaps 200 copies in Harvard Square. But then you'd have to go back in 90 days, the end of the consignment, and get your returns. And hopefully, some money. So the next step was realizing that we were in our own minds the only game in town. But in fact, there were other magazines, including the Partisan Review at Boston University and New Renaissance magazine, an old one from the Boston suburbs. And but still, they were functioning in their sense of exclusion, it felt to us. But given the network of these writers who were sort of like wandering monks, people knew about, there were other magazines starting. So Plowshares started in 1970, actually, 71 was the first issue, but we started in the 70 planning for it. And within the 3-year period before and after, I think maybe 15, 20 significant magazines started. Iowa Review, Field, Antius, Fiction International, the North American Review under Robley Wilson, of course, had a 100-year history behind it. but that there was this larger matrix elsewhere of literary magazines starting up, and with the same impetus, more or less, of having a younger idea of audience, the audience that should be, and also of value in writing, and writers that weren't being, sold to us, but that we had found. Sometimes as students, sometimes as colleagues, sometimes as just sheer admirers, and this amounted to a whole index of writing that wasn't on the radar of, say, the New York Times Book Review, nor was it on the radar of the distribute for pay people. The most famous Lit Mag distributor, of course, is Bernard de Burr. I think he was our first distributor. I think we had to make a name and get reviewed in the Boston Globe and some above ground places and get some grants and so forth. And finally, de Burr thought that we were worthy. And but even then, distribution amounted to sending, 250, 300 copies to de Burr, and he would go to the literary bookstores with them. And a policy of not sending back issues. He sent back covers. So they were a dead loss.
That was always difficult for, as I recall, very difficult for literary magazines to accept the notion that you'd send your magazine out, and if it didn't sell, you got back a cover. seemed at the time to many people almost sacrilegious to the work itself. You know, sort of reflecting the different value system of literary magazines compared to the values of the marketplace.
Well, also in the category, nobody knew what a literary magazine was. And I think that the first 20 years of Plowshares and magazines that were more or less kindred with Plowshares and ultimately were an expression of the policy and the funding from the NEA, there was a divide between the old university quarterlies, who under Title II had gotten all the library subscriptions that were post-World War II. So sometime in the 1950s, Partisan Review, Sewanee, Southern Review, and so forth, all got the same 4,000 libraries. And they were the academic libraries, not the public libraries. There's 30,000 public libraries, something like that. The public libraries, there's a learning curve here, right? Nobody was teaching us.
Right, no, it's all learned by doing.
And again, we're writers, right? And that isn't our training. So part of growing with a magazine or being committed to a magazine, you have to learn to be a marketer. You have to learn to be a public relations person. You have to learn, well, in addition to editing and setting type, you have to learn to be a business person to some extent. You have to learn to be political. You have to become nonprofit. And in those days, which we found when we first dealt with our state arts council, 501c3s were not being given around to magazines because the IRS didn't understand the difference between literary purpose and commercial purpose. All they saw was, oh, this literary magazine has some ads in it.
Right, it's a business, right? They would look at it as a business failing. And even I think at that point it was prior to the establishment of nonprofit theater, which is another kind of similar situation. You know, theater is theater. You know, the model was Broadway, and off-Broadway created a different aspect for, you know, governmental agencies in the same way literary magazines did.
And again, we're back to public publishing or public television, trying to explain how it's different and doesn't have ads, but they do have, you know, thanks to the donors, big letters. Anyway, I had to do the law. We were rejected once by the IRS and couldn't afford a lawyer, and you know, so I became a lawyer enough to write the case, and it was the first one in Massachusetts.
What, do you remember what year was it that you gained nonprofit status for 501c3?
I think 72.
Oh, very 72, pretty early. Yeah, you must have been one of the earliest, I think one of the earliest independent literary magazines that became nonprofit.
Well, Senator Edward Brooke was our state rep, he got involved. And one of the things that Peter O'Malley brought to the chemistry or to the essential accident of the magazine was that, being Irish, he knew the Boston Irish literary establishment, the era society. And in the history of Boston, so much of this is digression, but it is historical. Boston was essentially Brahmin, which means Protestant and Yankee. And when the Irish Catholics came in, many of them became politicians. But their bastion of validity was Boston College. And when the Jewish writers, editors, politicians, whatever, started to get involved, their bastion was Brandeis. And Harvard was the bastion for the Yankees. So we had this idea that later on that we would forge an audience somehow by appealing to these different traditional factions in Boston. This is a later story, but we had big fundraising readings and events that linked these worlds. And we did, for a while, find, we had an NEA development grant later on, and the burden, it was the first development grant, actually, for Literary Magazine. And the deal with that was that you started with $30,000, but you had, which was an enormous windfall of possibility, but you had to match it on a 3-1 basis. So our events, our fundraising events, reached out to an audience of about maybe as many as 2,000 people, and they would show up for a price at these readings. And
so did you organize, were they mostly in Boston, or did you go all over the country with those?
No, that's the Tom Jenks Narrative Magazine thing now. No, they were just Boston, and at one point I was looking at the possibility of direct mail, and when I looked at the Boston addresses for the New Yorker, for Harper's, and for the Atlantic, they all had only 4,000 people in Greater Boston, as opposed to, say, Time with a million circulation. or maybe their circulations are only 4,000. Right. The same 400, I don't remember. But it was small. This all gets under the topic of audience development and building, and that there should be an audience, and the things that we did to try to create one. But I think we need to backpedal. Getting lost in anecdotes.
No, that's all right. This is part of, I think that's the way history is told. So what was the circulation of Plowshares then in, let's say, and I think you look, you in your historical writing about Plowshares, I think you point to 1974 as a turning point where the magazine changed.
Well, there was a book chain, Paperback Booksmith, which wasn't Walden Books. It was something a little bit smaller in scale than that.
Yeah, I think they had about 30, 35 stores when at their height, maybe 40. But most,
they had 6 or 7 in Greater Boston, and the others were in the outlying suburbs, all the way down to Providence, Rhode Island. Through various friendships, one of which was with Dan Wakefield, who was living in Boston at the time, and was really, he was an Atlantic Monthly writer. He had done a Why Are We in Vietnam book. He was a new journalist. But he was also somebody who believed in literary community, and his kitchen was famous for entertaining mainly older writers. But he had a friend named Joan Norris, and she was the publicity director for Paperback Booksmith, and she's also a poet. And she had a couple of poems in Plowshares before I realized that, you know, what she was. And so our State Arts Council gave us a grant, a small one, for her to be an advisor. And so she taught me public relations, which I hadn't thought about before, you know. But she also went to the owner of Paperback Booksmith and said, here's this great magazine, Plowshares, which is becoming more and more visible and significant, and we should distribute it. So we had quite a draw. I think it was like 800 copies or something went to them every issue. And they tended to sell. One of the things I started to say before, which I kind of want to underscore, is that you had most of the circulations for the older literary magazines, the ones that were in the 1950s and earlier, were funded through this Title II library project. So they had the 4,000 research libraries. The new magazines had no research value as far as librarians understood it. So they rarely had more than, 50 libraries max. And these were very dedicated libraries that were interested in avant-garde, you know, right. culture and stuff.
It like actually had collections on, you know, so you were limited, you know, the number of libraries that collected pop culture, popular culture, but it wasn't even called that then. But yeah, you're right, it was a very small number.
So if you're an established magazine, why even go to the trouble of having a designed cover? You know, you can be the Sewanee Review. Just print Sewanee Review on it and send it to your 4,000 libraries and everybody's happy. But we were trying to sell on the street. So, you know, we weren't giving the thing away. We couldn't. And we needed each issue to earn the next issue, give or take a grand or two. So from the beginning, we wanted it to look professional. But then once we got this break with Paperback Booksmith, I took the risk and went to four-color covers. And I think we were one of the first ones to do that also. But the point was, by investing in a really attractive cover, people would take you off the stand, and they would be face out among the other magazines. And that was expensive at first, but one of the tie-ins that we had with this revolving editorship as it developed from just our small founding committee to then, you know, reaching out and getting more established and generous older writers sometimes, like Dr. Randall, or other people that were, you know, not exactly in Boston but outside, we started to reach more. And each editor had the opportunity to recommend an artist. So if they had in their own kind of pan arts sensibilities, you know, some painter that they really liked, I don't think we ever refused one. Yes, yeah, maybe one. But one of the artists was Michael Mazur, who was the husband of the poet Gail Mazur. And our first four-color cover was a fantastic painting of bright red flowers. And it was really beautiful. And he did a number of covers for us. And we also turned them into publicity postcards. You know, sent them out to sell the issues. But that was an important step. And then other magazines started to have four color. For the same reasons, though, you just don't want to make a pretty package. If you're going to be supported by retail, then you need a pretty package. And that was the direction we were taking, in despair of getting institutionalized subscriptions. But our circulation started at 1,000, it doubled to 2, and then it grew to 5 through the Booksmith connection.
Which is
as well as other distribution things that were being started by NEA, which you know a great deal about.
Yeah, I think 5,000 is a pretty good number, especially for that period. I think, you know, among the independent literary magazines, you're probably, Plowshares might have been the best-selling one. I'm not sure I can think of anybody else who would have sold more than you did in that period.
Well, we tended to earn a third of our budget, and the budget began at, what did I say, $2,000. And it steadily grew. I mean, part of the effort, as I said, was to have each issue earn the next. But it was also, if you did get a grant, would be to use it as growth capital. That if you got a $5,000 grant or a $10,000 grant, that had to tie in your budget. So you made choices in using that money that were basically wise investments and that earned it back. So our budget grew that way and topped out by the time after 20 years and when I was doing it was about $200,000.
Right, per year.
Right.
Yeah. So, and were you doing, how many issues per year were you doing in by then, by the 20th year? Was it two issues a year?
No, we did three. And we were a quarterly, so one of them was a double issue. That was our trick, and that also satisfied the post office when it came, given our nonprofit status. A really essential piece here was the nonprofit rate for postage, which made us competitive then with commercial magazines that had to pay more.
And so how many subscribers did you have, or even today, was subscription a significant component of your circulation and revenue?
Well, I had to hand address and bag every issue that went out. And we had a pretty stable base of 600 subscribers, individual subscribers, and then we had another couple hundred libraries. I got involved in something else in the marketing direction in the early and mid 80s, in that I by this time there had been a New York book fair. So the idea of making a collective noise again to help people understand what a literary magazine was, what its mission was, what its value was, whether it was your magazine or somebody else's. I mean, we had people from the book world coming to us and thinking we were a library magazine because they didn't know what literary meant. And really, in the history of this whole evolution, I would say that defining the genre itself was, and I don't think people thought this way either in the beginning, but it was the major hurdle. The idea of publicity, the idea of getting reviewed in above ground media, getting, because you can't afford to advertise, although we did begin advertising for $500 for these little 2-inch ads in the New York Book Review, New York Times Book Review. And each time that we started to publicize more widely like that, rather than subscriptions, what we got would be an avalanche of submissions.
Right. I think that's a common story for literary magazines and publishers, that the audience, you know, the famous Kenneth Patchen quote, you know, poets who don't buy poetry books are just a bunch of sons of bitches, you know, that it was, there's so many stories of magazines being deluged by more submissions than subscribers by far.
Well, George Garrett was a great spokesperson on this issue, and practically, if you have a 2,000 circulation, which we did say in the early 80s, we were getting 20,000 submissions. But it is a matter of honor. When, I don't know who it was, but some literary magazine started to say, well, we need to charge something for this. We need like a $2 submission fee, or you have to be a subscriber in order to submit. And the outcry on the grants panel when that, you know, was suggested was solid. You know, you can't do this. You're here to serve. You're a nonprofit. You're you know, the whole point of what you're doing is supposed to be public benefit. That was then.
Right. No, it things have definitely.
But Garrett said on you know it should be, you know, like a doctor's oath, you know, that to be a writer you have to be certified that you subscribe to at least one literary magazine.
Right. Well, and I know, and a lot of magazines have said to, you know, pointedly, whether you subscribe or not, at least read our magazine before you send something to us so that you understand who we are and what we publish, and don't waste your time or ours sending work that isn't fit for our aesthetic, however narrow or broad it may be. But I think a lot of writers don't have time. So
here, if I may, here's just a paragraph of something that I wrote in this public publishing essay in 1980. The future of literary publishing, as I view it, depends increasingly on the public sector, from government agencies to schools to public libraries to nonprofit organizations. I think what we're experiencing is a bankruptcy in spirit and practice of the notion that literature is a commodity. American consumers, in rejecting poetry and fiction of quality in favor of how-to books, thrillers, centerfolds, are the obverse of serious British readers who recently resisted an attempt to totally merchandise ragtime there. Both are testifying to literature's difference from consumer goods, its different character and value, and that is a difference that demands a system of evaluating, supporting, and publishing writers that is as distinct in concept and motive from our commercial system, in which I include publisher, reviewer, distributor, and bookseller, as PBS is from NBC. That was the credo. I mean, I was really passionate about this. And I'm still divided. I'm still, you know, of mixed mind about what the umbrella literature stands for. Is it a stop sign, as literary theorists would say? There's no difference between a stop sign and Shakespeare. Is it a canon? And if it is, whose canon? What are you supposed to do with the whole idea of market? If people don't want to buy something, does that mean it's not any good? How do you create a system of gatekeeping that can insist that art is for man's sake, I think was an NEA slogan, in a market-driven consumer world, people are acting out of what they want, not what they need. But who's going to tell them what they need? and who has the, you know, the hubris to presume? But, of course, time is a great arbiter. And I'm proud, looking back for three generations of Plowshares, that we did a pretty good job in identifying durable writing and writers who continued to grow as the magazine itself grew. So there indeed was a 1970s, 20-something world of writers. And a lot of them were bad, and some of them were good, and some of them were extraordinary. The network that Plowshares developed through the revolving editorship, the guest editorships, through the involvement of people who had come from literary communities that were smaller, and dreamed the dream of a larger literary community and what that meant, helped us to find or be found by really wonderful writers. I did a little book with Beacon Press some years ago called Breaking Into Print, and the people that had earlier first appearances in the magazine that I thought were, of course, I'd done other Plowshares anthologies, partly, again, as an attempt to publicize what is a literary magazine, but also to break into the review media through doing books. But Tim O'Brien, Jane Ann Phillips, Sue Miller, Carolyn Chute, Edward P. Jones, Mona Simpson, Howard Norman, Susan Strait, Chris Tillman, Carolyn Farrell, Melanie Raytown, Gina Berio. Didn't discover Gina Berio, but we've rediscovered her. And, you know, those are all people that were under my tenure anyway. I remember that Jane Ann Phillips really, I think, was probably sent to us by Frank Conroy when she was at the University of Iowa. And at that time, I didn't have an office. I had a second bedroom. A 3-year-old that was trying to climb over the book boxes to get in. I used to barricade for separation. And I had this old desk that I'd gotten off the street. And I remember getting a couple of these stories from A. Jane Ann Phillips. And I put them in a drawer, and they fell down behind something in the drawer. And I couldn't even afford file cabinets, to tell the truth. I had piles of manuscripts everywhere. Finally, we did get file cabinets through another grant for Book Affair, which was an association that I started to try to hit the libraries. But 6 months later, whatever, I pulled out this drawer, and I found El Paso by Jane Ann Phillips. And it was Faulknerian, and it was beautiful and knocked me out. And I wrote it right away and took it. She had, I think, already connected through Joe David Bellamy with the St. Lawrence Writers Conference, and met Sam Lawrence and Seymour Lawrence. And she developed a relationship. He did her first book, Black Tickets, and El Paso was one of the stories in Black Tickets. Remember, in those days, and I'm sorry for rambling, but in those days we had cold-type galleys, and I'm there on my light table, you know, pasting in little corrections and stuff. So I had done El Paso, and I had these long galleys for El Paso, and I sent them to Jane Ann. She was out in California at that time. And she sent them back, and they were just all red ink. She had totally, you know, changed, not the plot, but she had changed all her adjectives to verbs. She had made the action of the story dynamic instead of descriptive, and they were lapidary changes, but they constituted a lesson in creative writing, quote unquote, going from X to Y. But I had to cut in all the changes with a scalpel. It drove me nuts.
I one writer that we do share is Jane Ann, and I also had a very similar experience in working with her. The red line work that she did on Sweethearts, which was the small book that I published of hers before Black Tickets, was amazing, and it was also a lesson for me in patience in editing, because all of her changes were really good.
Well, one of the nice things that happened with Plowshares is that when you do discover a writer like that, and they start to grow, they publish their book or whatever, then you can go to them and say, hey, you want to guest edit an issue? And she did. She guest edited an issue together with Laurie Goldenson a couple years later when she had a Radcliffe Fellowship. I remember her, by then I had a storefront office, and I remember her coming to the storefront, which is as ratty as you can possibly imagine, and an illegal space heater, 1,200 square feet of storage. Again, the same old desk in which I had found her story, and a chair I'd gotten off the street. And I remember her leaning back in it and with sort of like this musing look, like, do I want to lead a life like this?
Well, you obviously did.
No, I mean, did she?
Oh, did she?
She was trying with my life.
Oh, I see. I misunderstood. No, I think, yeah, she probably didn't want to live a life like that.
And this is in a block in Watertown, Massachusetts, a blue-collar suburb of Boston between Cambridge and Waltham. And on the block was a newspaper distribution dump, an electronics store, a bar, a pizza store, and a laundromat. And kids used to sit across the street, because I'd be in there late at night, you know, with the lights on. And it had a plate glass window that said Plowshares on it. And they would throw crab apples in the plate glass window. And I was known as the library fairy. And, you know, then hang out, drunks would piss on the door at night. No, it was a nightmare. But into that storefront came Ray Carver and Alan Williamson and Frank Bedard and Thomas Lux and Fanny Howe and, you know, all these people who, Mary Carr, I mean, they're all personages, premature personages, but in this neighborhood that had no concept whatsoever of what was going on behind that door.
Well, in a lot of ways, that you just described the role of literature in America, you know, that it's this a storefront in a neighborhood that doesn't recognize what it's there for. That's really nice. Well, listen, DeWitt, I really want to thank you for spending so much time talking to me about Plowshares. It's been great and a real pleasure. Thank you for doing this.
Beware anybody who puts a microphone in front of my mouth.
This is what I'm trying to do. So thank you for doing this. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to DeWitt Henry, the founding editor, or one of the founding editors of Plowshares Magazine.